Good evening. Welcome to a book talk sponsored by the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. I'm David Kramer. I'm director of the library, and it's my privilege and pleasure to be here to learn with you about the material that David Fishman and his co-authors describe in this book, Nazi-looted Jewish Archives in Moscow. Now, I just want to begin by making a couple of comments, and then I'm going to pass it right off. I do admit that before I began in my position in the library, I probably would have had a hard time making sense of the joys of this book, shall we say? To explain what I mean, let me just share with you a brief but characteristic section of what you'll find in the book. This is a description of relating to materials from the American Joint Reconstruction Foundation in Paris. The description goes like this. The collection's contents are cataloged in three inventories. Each of these contains three sections: secretariat documents, documents of the finance department, and printed materials. The collection contains the JDC Charter of 1924, the JDC's assignment of legal rights to the new created American Joint Reconstruction Foundation, listings of transferred bonds, promissory notes, bills of exchange, and other securities, and so forth. Fair to say that for most people, this wouldn't be beach reading. those of us who have spent time around academies and libraries know that when you take materials that have been accumulated but not formulated, materials that represent the real life of organizations and of individuals, whether it be many centuries ago in the Cairo Geniza or whether it be very modern archives, by diving into these materials and considering their contents, one can learn more about the realities of life than from any other kind of source. While the surface of the description doesn't immediately yield its beauties, it's perfectly clear that a catalog of this sort is the entry to enormous riches. And in this case, riches that are very, very important because, as the title itself suggests, this is material that could well have been lost from very important chapter in our history. Thank God not only that the material survived, but that it has now been amply described, so those who want to study it will have access. With that very, very quick and I hope suggestive introduction, I introduce David Fishman, professor of history here at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Lights off, or?
I think it's easier to see if we keep this part of the... No, don't put all the lights off. Then everybody will fall asleep. No. Just the front.
Like that. No.
Okay. I'm an experienced teacher. I know what happens.
Okay. No.
No.
Otherwise, we get in.
No, I'm going to put it back on. How was that?
Good. That's beautiful. Oh. Beautiful.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. And thank you, David, for sponsoring this series and these events. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book with slides, and I think the story of this book is very poignant. In other words, what has happened to Jewish cultural heritage, to Jewish books, to Jewish manuscripts, yes, and to Jewish records, archival records, as a result of the Second World War. The Holocaust was a great trauma to the Jewish people, but it also is a great loss to the Jewish documentary record, to the Jewish literary and documentary legacy. This is one of those late finds, discoveries related to Jewish losses during the Holocaust. The book appeared last year. It's in cooperation, I should say, with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which microfilmed a good part of this material. Here are my co-editors that can't be here tonight. It's not my book. Mark Kopowiecki is the director of the Center for Jewish Studies at Russian State University for the Humanities in Moscow, which is also our program in Moscow. The seminary co-sponsors that center in Moscow. We call it Project Judaica. And many people here know Project Judaica well. Professor Rothman has taught in Project Judaica. And I want to acknowledge Ismar Shorsh, who's here, who has chancellor of the seminary, led to the founding and the sustaining of Project Judaica for so many years. Mark is our Moscow director and historian and co-editor of this book. And Vladimir Kuzilenko is director of the Russian State Military Archive, where these treasures are found. As I mentioned, this is a picture from Project Judaica, a group of students with the chief rabbi of Moscow, Pinchas Goldschmidt. I wanted to show students because actually a lot of the work that went into this book was done by graduate students from Moscow, who after finishing our program did the drudge work. There's no more thankless job than being either a librarian or an archivist. I think even an archivist more than a librarian. To pick up a piece of paper that's often undated and often with no author and hard to read in a strange language and a difficult script, and we have archivists here, and to figure out what is it so that you can describe it so that someone can come along and use it, is a very difficult job at a very lousy pay. So I wanted to show you that there's actually behind us, the three co-editors, there was a whole group of young people who brought many languages to the table, many skills to the table. This is the Russian State Military Archive in Moscow. That's what it's called today. The collections I'm going to talk to you about were formerly in another archive. Now they're here. This archive was called the Special Archive of the USSR. Osobyi Arkhiv, the Special Archive, very mysterious name. And in fact, it was a very mysterious institution. It was a top secret archive. It wasn't closed. Its existence was not known to anyone other than government officials. In Soviet times, all archives were under the NKVD, later KGB. In other words, they're all under a system of the security apparatus. But this one, even its existence was kept secret, and therefore no researchers knew about it. It was only discovered as existing in 1988-1989. All its material is of foreign, non-Russian origin. And just about all its material was acquired by the Red Army at the end of World War II, at the end and right after World War II. As the Red Army victoriously marched westward towards Berlin and conquered Germany, most of Germany, it found several places with large troves of papers and documents. And those papers and documents were sent to Moscow and eventually ended up in this special archive. What did they find? The biggest things they found are not of Jewish origin, not related to the Jews at all. The biggest collections are all these are collections that were looted by the Germans and then found by the Russians. The biggest collections are state collections, state archives, from the French government, from the Austrian government, from the Belgian government, and the Polish government. In other words, as the Nazis conquered Europe, they had a special agency to collect archives because government archives first and foremost, so that they could study the states and the governments and really accumulate lists of enemies of the Reich, enemies of the Third Reich. This was actually a special department of the Reich's Sicherheitsdienst, of the German security agency. So what the first thing I want to get across is this is an archive with vast materials, a certain part of which is Jewish material, but it's not only consisting of Jewish material. This special archive was incorporated into the Russian state military archive in 1999, and that's where the materials are today. Now I'm going to take you on a quick journey of how this all happened. This is a picture of the staff and administration of the Institute for the Study of the Jewish Question, Institute zur Forschung der Judenfrage, which was founded by Nazi Germany in 1939. In other words, the Jewish question was seen as so central to human civilization, Jews as such an insidious force, that even after there would be no Jews, there would be a need to study Jews and the Jewish question. This was going to be a, as they, the institute called it, Judenforschung ohne Juden, Jewish study of the Jews without Jews. And therefore, the Institute took a great interest in accumulating Jewish books, Hebrew and Yiddish books, manuscripts, and also archives, because they're hard to separate these things out from each other. You can see, you know, this is the insignia of the staff, one of the senior staff members of the Institute and of its operative branch. Its operative branch that did the looting. The operative branch that didn't just sit in Berlin and study Jews, but actually did the looting, was called the Einsatzstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg, the Rosenberg Squad. The Rosenberg Squad, and often the people are the same people, the Institute and the squad, you know, wore uniforms, and wanted to mention one of its senior staff members, Johannes Paul. Paul studied Semitics for a year at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in 1934. In other words, he knew Hebrew. He knew something about Bible, rabbinics. Of course, they didn't know that when the Hebrew University they accepted him to study that he was a member of a Nazi party. And he went back and used that knowledge as one of the head officials of the Rosenberg squad. This is a map that they actually made of from where they collected materials, everything leading to Germany, everywhere in Europe leading to Germany. And I should say, just to quickly go through this, these collections, those that are ended up in Moscow, come from all of these places. Most of the collections held in Moscow are from Paris, Berlin, or Vienna, but they come from Amsterdam, they come from Salonika, they come from Belgrade, they come from all parts of Europe that the Germans occupied and then seized these materials. The Institute and the Rosenberg Squad even did exhibits on using the seized, the looted materials to show the degeneracy of the Jews and put on display. Rosenberg himself came to observe the books, the papers that had been looted and seized. At the end of the war, the Red Army found materials in several places. This is a two-part story, actually. But the Red Army found, this is one such warehouse in Silesia, which is today Poland, was before the war Germany, which is today Poland. These are crates upon crates of seized, mainly papers, mainly manuscripts and archives. There were castles in Czechoslovakia where such materials were found. There were warehouses, as I mentioned, several such places. And it was all sent in these balls and boxes to Moscow in a very bad shape. The Red Army didn't see this as a very top priority as it was still liberating Europe. So they just stuffed stuff, threw stuff in to trains that ended up in Moscow. We often forget that most of Eastern Europe, well, all of Eastern Europe, and even a good deal of Germany and Central Europe, were liberated, after all, from the Nazis, not by the Americans and not by the British, but by the Red Army. And so this is the two-part story I'm mentioning, is a lot of material were taken by the Russians to Moscow, and then the material that fell under American control in occupied Germany, in other words, the British and the Americans came from the other direction and conquered parts of Germany. They also found large troves of books and of manuscripts and of papers. The Americans found this trove in Frankfurt, which was in the American zone of occupied Germany, and created this depot in Offenbach. The American approach, of course, was very different than the Soviet approach. The Americans created a large staff and sent these materials to Jewish libraries, major Jewish libraries throughout the world, the Jewish materials that were discovered. Our library has books that were received from the American government, the seminary library, from Offenbach. The Hebrew University Library has many books that it received from the from this depot in Offenbach. The YIVO Institute was fortunate enough to get a large part of its pre-war library and archive sent to New York from this depot in Offenbach. So the American approach was to distribute it, not to send it back, by the way, to Eastern Europe, but to distribute it among major Jewish libraries in Israel or Palestine, it was still then, and the West. The Soviet approach was to send it to different state repositories. We don't even have the full story of where everything went. There is a scholar, Patricia Grimstead Kennedy, who is studying only this question, the migration of where all those books and papers and manuscripts that the Soviets discovered in 1945, where did they send them? It's very hard to reconstruct, but the major place, the single largest place they sent it, was to this special archive in Moscow. I wanted to show you some items from what is there, and what was there, what is there, and what is there of interest to Jewish historians. Let me start broadly. There are 74 collections of Jewish provenance, as we call it. In other words, 74 collections of the records of Jewish communities, organizations, institutions. I'll just rattle off some of the big ones that I'm not going to show you about. Well, the Paris Bureau of the Joint Distribution Committee, and Linda Levy, who's the director of the JDC Archives, is here tonight. So the JDC had a major operation in Europe, of course. Its Paris Bureau was central to its operations. The records of that Paris Bureau of the JDC are in Moscow to this day. I'm looking at our audience to see what's of interest to people. The Central Association of German Citizens of the Jewish Faith, the Zentralverein, a large part of the Zentralverein's archive is in Moscow at this archive. There's more. Let me give you more examples. I brought this one because, yes, one of the large collections is that of the archive of the Berlin Jewish community. Berlin had a very active library and archive. All those records are in Moscow today, including materials that come from other German Jewish organizations, right? The Association to Combat Anti-Semitism, a farewell letter to our members after Hitler's ascension to power when the organization was closed. This is just one item from the records of the Jewish community of Vienna. A very large collection, and a very unusual, this is simply what we call it, a flow chart, explaining the different departments and the of the community and how it's administered. A vast collection. A lot of things I'd like to explain about our team is materials are misfiled. That was a big problem in creating this guide. Materials are misfiled. In this collection of the Jewish community of Vienna is a large amount of material related to the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. There is a Schneerson collection, and let me spend some time on this. There's a separate Schneerson collection, but a lot of the Schneerson material is not in the Schneerson collection. It's in the Vienna collection. Why it's there, I can't explain, but things got mixed up in the shipments. And you must realize the Russian archivists who held on to this material for decades didn't know Hebrew and couldn't care less about what some Hasidic Rebbe wrote 100 years ago. I mean, the Russians, by the way, were interested in the material mainly of the state archives. In other words, those French government archives that the Germans looted, for the Russians, that was a gold mine. For other governments, so the Jewish material was of the lowest priority for the Asovi Archive, a special archive. And they just put it in files and often wrote, you know, writings in Hebrew, not author unknown. All right? And then the archivist did his job, right? And we, the scholars, all suffer from it. You know, what use is it to see an inventory that says, writings in Hebrew, author unknown? So, actually, this explains to you what we needed to do, our team needed to do, which is to go through all those files, writings in Hebrew, author unknown, and identify, actually catalog on behalf of the archive, their holdings, their Hebrew holdings. The materials of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, let me just briefly say that this goes back 3 or 4 Rebbes. In other words, the earliest material in this collection is from the Tzemach Tzedek, who's the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, from the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. And it includes material of all subsequent Lubavitcher Rebbes down to Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe himself. This material was apparently seized from Warsaw, the last place the Lubavitcher Rebbe lived before leaving for the United States. He lived in the Soviet Union, then left for Riga, and then in Warsaw. So there's material in this collection from Riga and from quite late, right up to the eve of World War II. So apparently, again, imagine this story. The collection is seized in Warsaw, taken to Germany, we don't know exactly to where, found by the Red Army, and taken back in the opposite direction to Moscow, where it sat for, and still sits to this day. Of course, the Lubavitch Hasidim have fought court battles and much more to try to get this material back, but they have not succeeded. I will take questions at the end. Another unusual collection, the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds fascinated the Germans, the Nazis, who they were convinced that world finance is controlled by the Rothschilds, was and is controlled by the Rothschilds. Therefore, to understand the world finance, the Jewishly dominated financial system, you must have the records of the Rothschilds. And they found and looted 2 major collections of the Rothschild Bank, the Vienna Bank, and the Paris Bank. And again, the Germans took them. The Russians later found them. And the exhibit sponsored by the Institute for the Study of the Jewish Question, you know, prominently displays the Rothschild archive. Jumping from place to place, a large collection is that of the Jewish community of Salonika, Greece, which was once, not before World War I especially, a very large and thriving Jewish community. This is, you know, from a Jewish youth organization in Salonika. This is interesting for another reason. A lot of collections were divided, were split. What do I mean by that? Some of the material was found in Silesia, but some of the material was sent on to Frankfurt. This may not be of consequence to you, but what happens next is of consequence. The material that was sent to Frankfurt was sent by the American government to the United States. The material, this part of this Salonika collection is at the YIVO Institute today. YIVO has a Salonika collection. Don't ask me why the American government gave it to YIVO, but they had relationships and ties. They found the Jewish archive. They said to YIVO, you take it. So part of the Jewish communal archive of Salonika is in New York today. Part of the Jewish communal archive of Salonika is in Moscow today. It's the same collection. However, that part was found in Silesia by the Red Army, and they took it, and it's now in Moscow. There's another such collection, Hitzem, which is the European branch or the world branch of Hayas. I think we all heard of Hayas. Again, YIVO has a Hayas collection, a large one, but there's a Hayas collection, Hayas Hitzem, as the European branch was called, in Moscow as well. So you get these divided archives, which hopefully now people will be able to study in their entirety. You find stray materials. If you've actually listened carefully, very little of the material in Moscow originates from Eastern Europe. It all originates from Central and Western Europe. But you do find some stray material related to East European Jews. The Lubavitch collection is the most biggest one. And you do find things like ID cards, like this one, the member of Hechalutz. The Germans looted two major Jewish repositories. They looted the rabbinical seminary in Vienna, and by the way, also the rabbinical seminary in Breslau, which is our predecessor, JTS of Breslau. But especially a lot of the material from the library of the rabbinical seminary in Vienna ended up in Moscow. That means that a lot of older material, not related to modern Jewish history, but Kabbalistic manuscripts, are found among the material in Moscow. Yes, you have, this is a printed Machzor, but there are many Kabbalistic manuscripts, mainly from the 18th century. A lot of rabbinic responsa and sermons, again, mainly from the 18th century, though there is something earlier, that's found in these collections in Moscow. But it ends up in unusual places. You know where this is found? This is found in the collection of the Association of Jewish War Veterans of Austria, the Austrian Jewish War Veterans Collection. In other words, the researcher who uses this book needs to use the index. Because if you look according to the name of the collection, you're never going to find what you're looking for. But a student of Kabbalah or of rabbinics will find a treasure trove. A lot of the materials that the Russians took were German state records. Not things the Germans looted, but wherever they could, the Russians took German state records. And there are vast records of ministries and agencies of Nazi Germany that are held in this archive in Moscow today, including, for instance, the administration of the Auschwitz death camp. the records of the administration of the Auschwitz death camp are held in this military archive in Moscow, including this first design plan of a crematorium. This is just one example out of literally thousands of such documents. And I'm approaching the end because I'm eager to answer questions. I brought the Rothschild collections because that's a happy story. Many of these collections have been returned by the Russians to their countries of origin. Many yes and many no. The Rothschild is a very happy story where the Rothschild family, which is now based mainly in England, and the Rothschild Library in England, got back both Rothschild collections, the Vienna branch and the Paris branch. Other major Jewish organizations that have gotten back their collections, well, the most important is the Alliance Israélite Universelle. This is a very prominent French Jewish organization. Again, the Alliance archive was in Moscow, a large part of it. It was returned. Usually these things happen through government-to-government negotiations. In other words, the Russian government and the French government reach a deal, and the material is returned to the French government, which then returned it to the Alliance, or even to the Rothschilds. That's the way it worked. The French government represented the Rothschilds. So there are 20 years ago, this archive had a lot more Jewish collections than it has now. Many have been returned, but a lot of, first of all, some communities have failed or have been frustrated. The Salonika community wants to get back its collection from Moscow, but has not been successful. There are talks with the Austrian government about returning various Austrian collections, including some of the major Jewish ones. So this is a story, and of course the Lubavitchers have been putting up a fight but have not been successful to date in getting back their collection. So this is a story in flux, and it's a very controversial archive. Let's put it boldly. It is clearly, entirely consists of material that was not acquired through conventional means and does not belong to the Russian government. The one body of material the Russians are not giving back and are adamant, besides Lubavitch, that they're adamant not to give back, are the German materials. And the Germans actually have not even raised a claim. Their perspective is that the Germans have nothing to ask or demand of the Russians. The Germans who began the war, who destroyed all of Europe, and the Russians won't even... It's a very emotional topic, but they consider it the least that they are entitled to hold on to this material after the millions of Russians who died in the war. So I guess the last thing is I should thank those who have made the project possible. Major agencies were the Claims Conference, the Memorial Foundation, the Rothschild Foundation, and hopefully, as I write in my preface, it's a step towards Hashavat Aveda, the returning of lost property. In other words, which is a mitzvah. These things were lost. They belong to the Jewish people. They belong to our history. And hopefully it's a step towards returning them to Jewish history. And it also reminds us, the whole project I think reminds us, how precious every piece of paper we have that comes from pre-war Europe is. We should not, we lost, and this story tells you, a great deal of our cultural legacy in the war. A great deal of books and manuscripts and papers were destroyed, along with the Jews who were destroyed. So every time we hold up anything that originates from pre-war Europe, we should realize how precious it is, and this story, I think, goes to reinforce that. Thank you. I'd be happy, either not only questions, but even comments or reactions.
After the war, World War II, after the war, Israel, I guess the Sokhnut and the JDC sent out Israeli scholars to the devastated cultural centers of Western and Central Europe to gather up what they could for transshipment back to the then Palestinian libraries.
Right.
Has there been any aftermath of those gatherings?
Well, there's a whole book, or a big part of a book, that's about that operation, you know, that involved Professor Gershom Scholem, among others, to retrieve materials all across Europe and send it to the National Library in Jerusalem by Dov Shidorsky, who was the former chief librarian at Tel Aviv University. So the matter has been studied, and those books are in Jerusalem. Those books are, yes, it's very true. And there was competition, as you're hearing, between American Jewish scholars, such as Thelo Baron, and the Israeli Jewish scholars, such as Scholem, about where these various materials discovered in Europe after the war, where it should go. The American officials tended to just divide it, what they thought was an equitable formula, some to Palestine, some to America, some even to other places.
Is the reason for the Russians holding back materials correlated to the possibility that a lot of history that towards the Jewish people in much of Eastern Europe, including the Ukraine and parts of the former Soviet Union, had similar characteristics to Nazi Germany itself?
No, I don't think so.
There's other historical issues that are not being have not been disclosed for the reasons withholding these documents.
Why are the Russians not returning all the Jewish?
There has to be a reason for this.
The short answer is, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. They have it. I would say if somebody else wants it, that immediately increases its value. That's the way this world is. If you hold on to something and somebody else wants it, it must be important, must be valuable. So you don't give up something for nothing. Let me put it that way. You don't give up something for nothing. This is the way of their thinking. And it has to go into the mix of intergovernmental relations. In other words, that's why they have given back to many countries. But it goes into the mix of the relationship. I don't think there's anything sinister here other than it's cynical.
It sounds
cynical. It's cynical, but it's not sinister, if I can make that distinction.
Questions. I don't know if I'm sounding naive, but you made it sound as if the Russians were particularly interested in the Jewish archives, and I'm wondering why they even hold on to them. My first question. And my second question
is
the Jews of Salonika asked Ivo for those papers that Ivo has.
Did they, you're asking?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I really just don't know. The second question, I don't know. So I can't answer that. The world of Jewish archival collections is in constant controversy. I'm just going to respond to that part first, which is, for instance, the Vienna Jewish community. Today's Vienna Jewish community is demanding, would like to get back this collection that's in Moscow, but it's also like to get back a very large collection of the Vienna Jewish community that's in Jerusalem at the Central Archive for the History of the Jewish People. And there's a court case in Tel Aviv with the Vienna Jewish community demanding back this material from Jerusalem to Vienna. And one of the counterclaims is, you're not the heirs or continuers of the Vienna Jewish community from before the war. Many, the leaders of the Viennese Jewish community today are not old Viennese Jews. Some of them are Israelis. Some of them are Polish. In other words, so there's a whole controversy going around, and that involves a collection in Jerusalem, the part of this collection that's in Jerusalem. Why didn't the Soviets destroy these collections? I'm not sure exactly, but I think the simple answer is if it was of value to the Germans, to the Nazis, it must be of some value. Again, it's that kind of thinking. If they thought it was important enough to hold on to, you hold on to it. Again, it was not treated in any way. It was just held on to for decades.
Right, that's why I thought there seemed to be a lack of interest until there was an interest, and then they realized what they had, just as you spoke.
And again, it's all foreign material, meaning non-Soviet material, material from the West. That does make it of some kind of utility and of interest to the Soviets. There is some use to know. For instance, I didn't mention the records of the World Jewish Congress in the 30s. It was founded in the 30s. The records of the World Jewish Congress are found in Moscow. Well, Nachum Goldman was a real living person for a long time. You know, if you can know something about the youth of Nachum Goldman and who are his connections and who are his buddies, that may have some political and even diplomatic utility for the Soviet government. So I think the fact that it was Western material, non-Soviet material, made it of some kind of interest.
But they never did anything.
They never did anything. That's true. They really never. Well, some collections were the easy collections were cataloged. The World Jewish Congress was cataloged. But once they hit a Hebrew manuscript or a Yiddish letter, they threw up their hands, you know.
What happened to the materials that were in Russia itself, Odessa and other cities? Did they pull that and combine it with this library?
No, that's a much bigger story. And our Project Judaica is doing a comprehensive survey of Jewish archival collections in the former Soviet Union. But that's an enormous volume of material, and it's held in many, many places throughout Russia and Ukraine today. As there are Jewish... But that's a different story. That's true. That's a story of how communism closed down Jewish life, basically. And when it closed down Jewish life, the Soviets, they seized the record of that life. They seized Jewish libraries, manuscripts, Torah scrolls, and those things are in Soviet. That's a different story. In other words, what you're hearing is Jewish books, manuscripts, archives were at the mercies of the two most murderous regimes of the 20th century, both Nazism and communism. And they seized, you know, they seized and took and destroyed and held a lot of Jewish material. Not only the Nazis, but also the Soviets.
I assume they'd be less willing to release a lot of that material because it speaks to Stalin's period.
Yes. And to whom should they release it, let me ask you? To whom? The Zionist organization of Odessa, the records of the Zionist organization of Odessa. Right? Who should they give it to now, 100 years later? There is no Zionist organization in Odessa, and if there was, could they really claim to be the legal heirs to the materials of the Zionist organization of Odessa? There are many issues about this. I'm sure the Central Zionist Archives in Jerusalem would say if anything Zionist belongs to us. But that case is not crystal clear.
What is the access like today to the archive? Is it completely public? Are permissions required?
It's completely public. Access is completely public, like in just about any other Russian archive. I had to put it that way, right? In other words, yes, you do have to have, get a letter that you have to get permission. Copying is a problem, though possible, but very expensive. But access is available. the problem till now was, and still persists even with this book, what we call intellectual access. In other words, in theory, you can order any file you want to. But how do you order a file that's named, you know, Writings in Hebrew, Author Unknown? Right? In other words, yeah, sure, go, be my guest. Look through hundreds of files, thousands of files, though actually Russian archives typically have a limit of 5 files a day. And if you're lucky, 10 files a day. So if you have a collection of literally hundreds of files or even thousands of files, and they're all listed, Writings in Hebrew, Author Unknown, it would take you months or maybe even years to go through all those files. So this guide is a partial solution to that problem. So I gave you the full answer, which is, in theory, access is open. In practice, it's very hard to work in Russia, in Russian archives.
So is this essentially the only finding aid available for anything in that archive?
No. You're asking a professional question. And no, and we do refer in the book to more detailed finding aids. There are real detailed inventories, not so much of the Hebrew material, but the German Jewish records. They're very detailed file-by-file inventories. That's good intellectual access. But many of the collections have quite poor intellectual access.
And the finding aids are there, not online.
Oh, some are online. Buy the book. Yeah. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
David, thank you for a really wonderful presentation, and I promised that it would take on a life different than what I had, you know, the selection I read at the beginning. Right? I have no doubt that that's exactly what's happened, so thank you very much. There are evidently some copies of the book for those of you who would like them. The author, I'm sure, one of the authors, editors, will be happy to sign and leave space for the other authors when you find them, right? And on your way out, please notice the post that's in the lobby on the way to the gates. There are several other very, very interesting library book events coming up in the next month or so, and we invite you to come back to those events. So thank you for coming.